movie set to multiplex. It's the business of film with James Cameron Wilson.
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me? Who's got you?
I am not an animal!
Where the devil are my slippers?
It is time for the business of film with James Cameron Wilson as we look at last weekend's box office. So, James, how is the box office looking given this extraordinary weather?
Well, the heat wave has really done its worst, with high temperatures equating to low takings, making last weekend the sorriest for years. In fact, the box office was off 53% from the previous weekend and recorded the lowest overall take since October of 2013. It's been a disaster for the multiplex. Still, at number one...
Can I just say something just before we go into that? Because this is odd, isn't it? I know you know America fairly well and go over there frequently, but in the United States... summer's a big time because people go to the cinema because they're air-conditioned. Well, I mean, a lot of our cinemas now here are air-conditioned, so clearly people sort of seem to forget that it's a way of getting cool.
I think it's a mindset, really, that the British have not managed to get into. Certainly, when I went to Australia, that's what everybody does in Australia. And it was extraordinary to be sitting there with everybody with bare feet and shorts and T-shirts watching films, whereas I tend to... put a tie and jacket on when I go to the cinema. No, it's very different here. It's a mindset, really.
Well, and possibly a failure on the part of the cinema chains. You'd think they would splurge a bit of money to try and attract their customers in. But anyway, as you say, it's a mindset. Seems very, very odd, but that's the way things are. So, given that it's a rather reduced box office, what is our number one film?
Well, until last weekend, only Beauty and the Beast and the Lego Batman movie had managed to hold the top spot for three consecutive weekends. But now, Wonder Woman has lassoed that distinction as well, with a tidy £16.3 million in the bank to date. Doing very well indeed, which is quite extraordinary considering the other sort of female superheroes have done disastrously, from Elektra to Catwoman. But Gal Gadot, probably the most famous Israeli now on the planet, has changed all that. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, not maybe as much as the other film critics, but it's really three films. You've got sort of going back to her roots, where she grows up on this sort of island paradise, where she's trained to fight by Robin Wright, of all people. And then she goes to London with Chris Pine, who teaches her biology. And then, of course, she goes and fights the Hun. It's set during the First World War. And jolly good villains, too. But then, of course, it all gets rather CGI-y near the end. And I kind of lost interest. But she's a fine, feisty heroine.
Okay, so that's Wonder Woman in the number one spot. And what is being kept out?
Well, number two, we've got The Mummy, which is the first installment of Universal Pictures' proposed Dark Universe series, all linked by Russell Crowe as Dr. Jekyll, as well as Mr. Hyde. Here, Tom Cruise delivers his least appetizing performance, I think, since he played Jack in Ridley Scott's Legend 32 years ago, which I don't know if you remember that, but that was probably the worst reviews he's got since The Mummy. However, it's considerably more engaging than the film number three, which is called Pirates of the Caribbean, Salazar's Revenge, which, as I keep on saying, the only good thing I could think of to say about this movie was I thought the production design was jolly good. But this is Javier Bardem playing the villain who sort of oozes black oil from his mouth, and his hair sort of takes on a life of its own. His hair is actually computer-generated, which is very odd. Johnny Depp, of course, is in it and got paid a small fortune. And he just plays this drunk bore throughout. It's very, very long. It's very, very confusing. And the highlight for me was a cameo by Paul McCartney playing Uncle Jack. Anyway, even worse, though, is the film at number four, The Moronic Baywatch. in which the funniest line is when Zac Efron is asked, "Are you dyslexic?" To which he responds, "No, I'm Caucasian." If that tickles your funny bone, then you're in for a laugh riot. Although I think this is just as unbearable as Zac Efron's other recent offerings. Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates, Bad Neighbors 2, and Dirty Grandpa. I can't remember any other actor in history who's made such awful films consecutively.
Well, the reason we can't remember them, of course, is because they've vanished completely from trace because they've made such bad films.
Yeah.
And as we pointed out before, you know, he had such promise earlier on. It made a film that we would advise people to seek out on home video, which is Me and Orson Welles, which I adored.
You both liked it.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, the film is called Me and Orson Welles and James Cameron Wilson. We all loved it.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah. Seek it out. Christian Mackay, brilliant as Orson Welles. And Claire Danes was also in it.
Yep. Wonderful.
Anyway, we have a new film at number 5.
Ah.
Now, I am a huge fan of history, particularly historical biography, but too many films have tried to cram an entire life into 2 hours. Consequently, you get a better feel for the talent of the makeup artist than the character portrayed. Here, we're talking about Churchill. And the director Jonathan Teplitsky and the screenwriter and historian Alex von Tunzelman have focused on just 96 hours in the life of the eponymous statesman. And these hours could not be more historic. With 156,000 Allied soldiers waiting to be unleashed upon the shores of Normandy in 1944, Britain's Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, is having second thoughts. And being the character he is, he has no qualms in putting the likes of Field Marshal Montgomery, Dwight Eisenhower, and even King George VI in their place. In spite of the massive logistical preparation already underway, Churchill thinks it would be a good wheeze to attack the Nazis from the Aegean Sea. And like any film dealing with intimate historical fact, a certain dramatic license will have been taken. And for that, we, the audience, must be grateful. The historian Alex von Tunzelman, who presumably knows her stuff, has brought the theatre of war alive through some really gripping backroom negotiations. And while we may not be provided with the sight of 100,000 men wading through the sea at Normandy, we do have some beautifully judged sequences between the powers that were. Do we have a clip?
We have a clip involving some of the powers that be.
Winston, General Eisenhower. Field Marshal Brooke, General Montgomery.
Mr. Churchill.
What a gathering.
Sorry to expose you to the English summer. We couldn't risk this meeting in London.
Well, just think, if Hitler were to drop a bomb on this little patch, he would, at one blast, destroy the entire high command of our Allied forces. Let's hope we get through it, eh?
So it must be one of the most portrayed characters, I guess, in film history.
Well, he is such a character, isn't he, with that sort of characteristic bulldog stance, the polka dot bow tie, the cigar and the hat. And I think directors in the past think if they've got somebody fat, they can actually get away with them playing Churchill. I think one of the weakest Churchills we've had in recent history was Timothy Spall in The King's Speech.
Speech.
I mean,
yeah.
He's a wonderful actor, Timothy Spall, don't get me wrong. He just was not Churchill. And I think one of the coups of this film is the casting. While Brian Cox, who we were just listening to then, he may be Scottish, but he at least was the same age Churchill was at the time, and he's even the same height. One can but think back to such odd casting choices as the looming Frank Langella as Nixon in Frost Nixon, or Anthony Hopkins as Nixon, or Anthony Hopkins as Picasso. Across the board, the performances here are tip-top, and I think Brian Cox will be looking at some awards come the prize season. Oh. However, of course, he will have to battle Gary Oldman, whose own portrayal of the British bulldog in Joe Wright's Darkest Hour is already mustering major Oscar buzz. He's currently the front runner to win the Oscar next year, Gary Oldman playing Churchill.
We have competing actors playing Churchill, competing for the gongs. That would be quite interesting. Of course, we had on TV in The Crown, we have extraordinary casting of John Lithgow as Churchill.
Yeah, John Lithgow's about 6'4". Churchill was 5'8".
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would like to say there was a couple of scenes that really registered with me. And there's a scene in which George the VI calmly persuades the Prime Minister to abandon his plans to accompany the troops to France. And this is all totally true. And there's the sequence is terribly, terribly moving as George the VI tries to persuade this bulldog not to go out on the ships to Normandy.
Presumably... Sorry, go on, James, sorry.
No, I was saying, as King George, I think it's probably the best thing that James Purefoy has probably ever done in his career. You were saying, Simon?
Yeah, well, presumably, sort of at the back of all this is Churchill's feeling of responsibility for the Gallipoli campaign in First World War.
Yeah, that is.
Which he must have been terrified it was going to happen again.
Yeah, precisely. This is a character study. And, of course, he's making the terrible mistake that... you cannot repeat history. And it's really, really interesting and well done. There's also another scene I should mention, sort of from monarchy to the menial, the moment when Churchill is challenged by his own typist. Is a very emotional tour de force, but big thinkers can sometimes get so wrapped up in the bigger picture that they forget the feelings of those who must serve them on a day-to-day basis. Ella Purnell plays his typist, and very good she is too. And what I liked about this is that you've got, you know, the heads of state and the heads of armies, etc., but you've also got the little person, and you've got their perspective as well, represented here by Ella Purnell, who is previously in Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. I think she was the young girl in that. She's going to certainly go places. This is a film which I was completely gripped by. I thought Brian Cox was terrific. And it's funny because when he's doing his speeches leading up to the famous speech at the end, he completely sort of tunes into Churchill's famous sort of intonation. Yes. But normally, you know, it's not like that. You're not getting a sort of caricature of Churchill. Except when he's, you know, when he's on the radio.
Mm. Oh, well, it sounds like the sort of film I think I would rather enjoy. Brian Cox, of course, I like enormously. He was very good in a film called The Flying Scotsman, I seem to recall.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
We're talking the business of film with James Cameron Wilson. So, Churchill is at number 5, James. What's next?
We have another new film. Thank heavens, which is at number 6, called Gifted. I've always loved films about child prodigies. There is a sort of inherent drama built into the material as grown-ups and strangers marvel at the talent of toddlers. It's like the scene in Jurassic Park when Sam Neill and Laura Dern first see the dinosaur. So having recently loved Queen of Katwe, which only lasted about a week, which was tragic, which is about a 10-year-old chess prodigy.
Very, very good film.
Yeah, about a 10-year-old chess prodigy from the slums of Uganda. I had very high hopes for Gifted, particularly as it's from the director Mark Webb, who made 500 Days of Summer, which I really loved. I don't know if you saw that, Simon?
I did. I wasn't as keen on you.
Really? No. Oh, I thought it was enchanting, sweet, clever. Anyway,
no, I loathe Zooey Deschanel's character in that. I'm afraid that sort of burbling pixie sort of thing jarred on me.
This is the story of a blue-collar boat repairman played by the American Chris Evans, who lives with his late sister's daughter, the 7-year-old Mary, played by McKenna Grace. He knows she's brilliant and gifted, but he just wants her to be dumbed down into a decent human being. But when Mary is finally packed off to school, she not only shames her fellow first graders, but her maths teacher too. She is a mathematical genius. And then we have the entrance of English actress Lindsay Duncan, who plays Chris Evans' estranged mother, who believes that her granddaughter needs to pay the price for her greatness. And so a custody battle ensues, which proves astonishingly dull. One of the problems I had with the film is that I couldn't understand what Mackenzie McKenna, who plays Mary, was saying. What came out of her mouth was as baffling to me as the mathematical formulae she kept on solving. It also seemed terribly unfair that a 7-year-old who looked that astonishingly beautiful could also have a brain to match. But then Uncle Chris Evans is no Quasimodo either, and he spends all his spare time down at the bar nursing a beer on his lonesome, and then goes home to an empty bed. The treacly music also makes sure that we don't take any of this remotely seriously, which I'm afraid left me pretty bored.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. But we can recommend people see the Queen of Catway, which is now available on home video, because we both like that enormously.
Yes, we did. I mean, I always try to look for something good in every film, and I had such high hopes for this. I mean, were it not for Lindsay Duncan... I mean, it was kind of weird when I first saw Chris Evans and Lindsay Duncan on the poster in my local cinema. I thought, that just doesn't look right. That's so weird, because she's this wonderful sort of theatrical actress known for Liaison Dangereuse on the stage. But were it not for her, whose character's moral ambiguity and brittle superiority really gives the film some real drama, I probably would have nodded off in this heat.
Oh, dear me. Dear me. Well, let's press on then, James. That was number six. What's number seven?
Number seven, we have My Cousin Rachel, a cracking yarn from the novel by Daphne du Maurier, well played by Rachel Weisz, directed by Roger Michell, incidentally, whose own son, Harry Michell, has directed his first film, Chubby Funny, which goes on limited release from next week, written by Harry Michell and starring Harry Michell and Jeff Rawl. So we need to look out for that. Limited release. It'll be interesting to see how he compares to his father, who has done some really wonderful films like Notting Hill and The Mother. And we talked about him last week. And I loved My Cousin Rachel. I thought it was sort of a slow burner and quite gripping, largely because I think the character, the moral ambiguity of the character, and so well played by Rachel Weisz. You disagreed with me.
Well, yes, but then, as we pointed out at the time, you felt that your palette had perhaps been sort of tarnished by all those sort of superhero movies, and this was rather refreshing. I hadn't seen as many as you, and I confess the word slow I agree with. I just didn't buy into the main character at all. I felt it was badly scripted, and that Roger should have got somebody else to do it. But, you know, all manner of opinions accepted here. What's next then, James?
Number eight, we have Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Long Haul, which is, as you know, the fourth installment in the Wimpy Kid franchise from the director of Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Roderick Rules, and Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Dog Days. Maybe it's time for David Bowers to expand his remit. Not a film I particularly want to see. I have saw the original, and that was quite enough. Number nine, we have Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, the strongest holdover of the weekend, with just a 41% decline. At number 10, we've got a new film, Whitney. Now, I don't know how to say this title. I want to say Whitney... Can I Be Me? But there's no question mark on the end of the title. So
we could talk for the whole of the 24 minutes, James, about bad punctuation in movie titles, but perhaps we better not.
Well, it's Whitney, Can I Be Me? The first documentary officially authorised by the Whitney Houston estate, telling the unvarnished story of the singer's life, directed by Nick Broomfield and Rudy Dolezal. I would really like to see it. I don't think it's probably up there with Amy, that wonderful documentary about Amy Winehouse. But we will see. I might be pleasantly surprised.
Yes, 2 weeks' notice, I think, is the one we discussed a while ago, didn't we, with Sandra Bullock and Hugh Grant, where there was no apostrophe, and we rather dislike that. Well, James, so that's the 10. Anything you want to look at below the top 10, or should we move on to other matters?
I think we should move on. We've got plenty to talk about, and I would like to talk about a remarkable film, I thought, which is now available on DVD and Blu-ray for the first time, a restored version. It's a film called Mandy, and I always remember it was a real favourite of my parents, and I never did get to see it until a few weeks ago. And I think... at the time of its release, which was 1952, it was remarkable both for its tackling of a taboo subject, disability, and for its almost documentary-like approach to it. I mean, we're talking 1952, the year of Singing in the Rain and The Quiet Man, but here was the story of a cozy middle-class couple who've come to terms with the fact that their young daughter cannot hear. based on Hilda Lewis's 1946 novel, The Day Is Ours, itself inspired by the work of the author's husband with deaf children. The film is a very straightforward and unsentimental account of a family ripped asunder by shame. Mandy herself, born with a congenital hearing defect, is expressively played by the six-year-old Mandy Miller. And Jack Hawkins is so effective and so low-key as Mandy's teacher and as her mother's confidant. And as the man who tries to find the little girl her voice, it's so poignant that he, the actor Jack Hawkins, lost his own voice in 1966 from throat cancer. And I was sort of choking up just from the irony of that. I mean, the film features many genuinely deaf children, as well as the Royal Manchester School for the Deaf. And under the direction of Alexander McKendrick, I felt it achieved an almost film noir intensity. But the film is more than just about a little girl learning to talk. It's about a seemingly idealistic family in crisis, with Mandy's father, played by Terence Morgan, a very weak and frustrated man with a bizarrely unhealthy closeness to his own mother, which you felt might almost go into another film.
Yes.
I thought it was very strange. It was almost Hitchcockian.
It's very popular and interesting as well, of course, that this is an Ealing film. People tend to think of Ealing as being a studio that made comedies because they produced much more. I mean, this was not long after films like Kind Hearts and Coronets and The Lavender Hill Mob and The Man in the White Suit. But it's
Was directed by Alexander McKendrick.
But extremely interesting. I thought perhaps some of the subplot, the argument among the sort of parents, grandparents and the mother about how Mandy should be treated, whether they're, you know, should be costed or sent to this school. And some of it I thought perhaps was just a little bit too involved. I'd almost have liked to see rather more of Jack Hawkins and the process. But I agree, it's incredibly moving. I was disappointed I couldn't spot, an 8-year-old Jane Asher in there. She's obviously in there somewhere. She's got a named part, but I was obviously not paying enough attention to Zia.
Well, apparently Alexander McKendrick was really taken by her flaming red hair, which is why he cast her as one of the deaf children at the beginning of the film. But of course, it's a black and white movie.
Yes, yes. And quite extraordinary. And interestingly as well, now the girl playing Mandy was not actually deaf. That's Mandy Miller, who was also, you know, for a little while was a child star. But on the DVD as well, there's an interview with her, which I thought was extremely interesting, talking about that. Yeah. And she, in fact, talks about it being a black and white movie and how Phyllis Calvert playing her mother at one stage had these really weird purple lips because it would show better on camera under the arc lights, and how weird she found it. But also there's an audio essay from, which I think was originally on Radio 3, which I did hear, with Simon Heffer, who is a big fan of a lot of British movies, but talking about Mandy and setting it into context. And those extras I thought were really splendid, as indeed was the fact that we get to see some of London from the back of the grandparents' house, looking out over Hammersmith Bridge, which is extraordinary. 1952, just how desolate some of London still was.
Yes, yeah, I that's what I love about old films, just seeing London as it was, with this pristine, restored cinematography, is a real treat. We didn't mention Phyllis Calvert. She does get top billing in the film, after all, and she plays Mandy's mother, another terrific actress. That was probably the part that she is still best remembered for, I would say, Phyllis Calvert.
Well, we both think Mandy is fantastic. It's out now for home release, so we would recommend it strongly, particularly if you've got an interest in British film and indeed in British social history. James, I know we want to talk about more things, but we are sadly out of time as ever, but we'll be back with another Business of Film at the same time next week.
Silent breed is people!
Hoo-ah!
Mother of mercy. Is this the end of Rico?